I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Today, with recent concerns of voter impropriety, we'll check in with a local election board to find out what steps are in place to prevent voter fraud this election. Then, the story of Lloyd Gaines, a black man who was denied entry to MU's law school based on the color of his skin. His 1938 lawsuit went all the way to the Supreme Court, which ruled in his favor. Before the next semester, he mysteriously vanished. To this day, no one knows why, but there's no doubt his case played a role in the fight for equal opportunity in education. Finally, the latest edition of State House Blend, Missouri. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Several weeks ago, we had a conversation on this show about just how infinitesimal the chances of voter fraud are. Donald Trump, however, continues to cast doubt. As reported in the Chicago Tribune, when the presidential candidate was speaking to supporters in Altoona, Pennsylvania, he expressed shock that the state had no voter ID law, then went on to say, "I hope you people can sort of not just vote on the 8th, go around and look and watch other polling places and make sure that it's 100% fine." This morning, we're going to go straight to one of the bodies charged with making sure elections are fair and free with the Jackson County Election Board. Joining us now by telephone from the board's warehouse is Tammy Brown. She's one of the directors of the Election Board. Tammy, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk on what I hear is a very busy morning for you all down there.
We are busy. We just got 240,000 ballots delivered, so we're sorting and packing to head to the polls.
And those ballots are going to be the ballots that people are marking up on Election Day?
Correct.
Okay. Well, let's get right to this, Tammy. Other than poll workers and voters, who else is allowed into polling locations on Election Day?
Ourselves, election officials from the board, if we have to be deployed out to a poll, the police, if they're called, and challengers and watchers, but they must be approved by party chairs and then the election board directors. And they have credentials to present to the judges at the polling location.
And that's pretty much it.
That's it. Mm-hmm. The challengers can be replaced during the day. So they might have two challengers assigned to a poll between 6 and whenever the poll closes. And watchers have to stay the entire day. Watchers cannot be replaced. So if they leave, no one can come in and take their place.
You know, Tammy, after casting their votes, can people stick around and observe what's going on, as Donald Trump sort of suggested here a few days ago?
No, our judges would escort them out. The polls are going to be crowded anyway. Once they voted and received their stickers, deposited their ballot, we have somebody at the ballot box showing them the door. But, yeah, we discourage visiting, and, I mean, it's... this is a busy election, so we're going to be running people through as quickly as we can.
What about on the outside of polling locations? Can anyone stay and observe who's coming and going?
They can. They have to stay 25 feet from the entrance to the poll. So we've got several polls that are going to have exit polling going on. We've been notified of that. Campaign people, whether it's a question or a candidate, they'll be there handing out literature. We've always just told the voters, they call us, they think they work for us, and we're like, no, you don't have to talk to them. If you choose not to, just keep walking. Same with signs. We get complaints about candidate signs, and we're not the sign police. We do send out to the parties that there are people who, we leave it up to the churches and the individual buildings. It's either no signs or everyone signs allowed. And we kind of leave it to the building to determine how they want that to take place. So we do get some upset candidates when their signs aren't allowed to be placed at the polling locations. But while we're renting those buildings for the day, it is up to those individual buildings, because they end up having to pick up all the signs and all the mess that remains and get rid of them. So we leave that in their hands.
I'm talking with Tammy Brown of the Jackson County Election Board. Who does the Jackson County Board of Elections have in place, Tammy, to watch out for any voting impropriety here?
Well, we will get several calls during the day, and we will investigate quickly. Our voter files are very clean. We just put 52 people in inactive. We sent transfers out 35 days ago. Have not heard back from those people, so we did put them in inactive status. So if they go to vote, they'll have to contact the office because we've gotten mail back on them. That's part of our canvas. We canvass every election. And if they have not sent updated information back, they'll have to get a hold of us to update their address, and we'll get them to the right poll.
But if you hear of a problem at a polling place, how do you respond? Who goes out and checks it out?
Well, initially the judges take all the information in. We do have deputy teams.
The judges, judges who are already on site, right?
At the polls, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can't handle it, we deploy our deputy teams that are out in the field. And if it's a problem they can't handle, Bob or I, the two directors, go out.
What is built into the voting process that prevents someone from voting twice, Tammy, or pretend to be someone else and cast a vote?
Well, as far as voting twice, we have electronic poll books that are peered. Whether we have two of them or four of them or six of them at a poll, they're all peered. So once a voter's checked in, they cannot check in again. We did have an instance, I'm not sure about the year. I think it was 2012, where a young lady came in to vote out of Blue Springs, and they pulled her up and said, "You've already voted." And she said, "I just got off work. There's no way I could have voted." But somebody had come in and voted under her name. We assume, we did some investigation. We could never prove. The signature was illegible. We couldn't tell who had signed the precinct register. But they had open mailboxes at their apartment complex. And, of course, when all you need is a utility bill or something like that with your name and address on it, as long as you've got open mailboxes out there, that can happen.
Mm-hmm. Does the state or federal government have the authority to observe the voting going on?
I'm sorry, the who?
The state or federal government.
We would not allow them in our polls unless they came through us first.
Huh. Why is that?
Well, because we're running the election, and it's up to us to protect what goes on in the polls. So we just don't allow anybody else in the polls. Even the news media, most news media knows to give us a call first so we can forewarn the judges, tell them what station, how many people, how long they'll be there, what they can and can't do. So we protect our polls and the process.
If a voter out there does observe something questionable going on at their voting location, what should they do?
They should call the election board immediately so we can deploy somebody out there to see what is going on.
Okay. You know, St. Louis Public Radio, Tammy, just asked elections officials over in the St. Louis area what keeps them up at night 2 weeks before this presidential contest. Some interesting responses, and I was wondering if you would react to some of them. Erwin Schweitzer, who's chairman of the St. Louis Board of Election Commissioners, said the biggest challenge is that we have an organization that has 25 full-time employees, but then comes election day, we have close to 1,000, meaning polling workers, election workers. So there's lots of people who aren't familiar with and used to all the procedures that have to be followed. I'm wondering, how much of a concern is that to you?
Oh, it's always a concern. I mean, so far, we're not done training yet, but we are in the process of running 1,600 judges through training right now. And we hope they all listen and follow the rules, but it's tough when you pay them, so they are a board employee, but they truly are volunteering their day for no more than we pay them. They're there. They're going to be there at 4:40. In the morning, and they usually don't walk out of the poll till 8 or 8:30 at night.
Wow.
And still have to bring all of the ballots and election supplies to the office. So, it's a long day, and we have some very, very good judges, and we have an excellent trainer that goes through every possible process that we do pile a lot on the federal elections. We've got the provisional ballots, that are only allowed in federal elections, so they don't do those in February or off-year elections or in April elections. So that's a whole process, that you have to get through. If you can't find a voter and you can't get through on the phones to us, vote them provisionally. If we find them, their vote will count. If they're not registered, it won't. So we do pile on, and of course there's more electioneering going on in the big elections than in the smaller ones. So, you know, that's kind of unnerving for them. And if they do have a challenger or watcher standing over them, you know, it does make them a little nervous. But we do have a good group of judges, and we're going to have over 100 people just in our office answering phones and opening absentee ballots.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we are a staff of 22. So, you know, it is odd to have your staff there, and then you pile on another 80-some people in your office, and it does get a little hectic. So presidential elections are, it's always good to have them in the books and put them to bed.
How much do folks get paid for that long day you just mentioned?
Our supervisory judges and our what we call e-judges that work the laptops get paid $200. But that's for the day, and then their 2 to 3 hour training they come to. So
Wow. That's
a total of 200 they get, and then our regular judges get 185.
So no one's getting rich here.
Nobody's getting rich working the election. They do it out of the goodness of their heart.
A caller wants to know, Tammy, if absentee ballots have gone out.
Oh, yes. We started absentee voting September 27th.
Mm-hmm. Another election judge official over in the St. Louis area told St. Louis Public Radio what keeps them up at night worrying about the election. And Eric Fay from St. Louis County said this, everything. And I kind of mean that, he said. There are so many moving parts to an election, and as a director, you can't control every single piece of it. You just hope it all holds together and you make it through Election Day. Does that describe your philosophy?
It does. It does. You depend on a lot of people. Our judges out in the field, you know, you hope they make good decisions, and your staff, because there's no way. I mean, I this job is proofing. That's all you do. And then you test. You load the machines, you test them, you make sure they're counting right. You get them all sealed up. You get them out to the polls. You train your judges and just hope you don't have equipment problems, ballot issues. You hope your judges show up. With cold and flu season, you know, it's scary. And
no.
Then, of course, if the weather turns, we will have judges, you know, if there's any snow in the forecast, it's like, nope, I'm not doing this. So we back up. We have standbys in place to send out. But, you know, you just keep your fingers crossed and hope all these moving parts all fall into place and you have a successful election with wide margins. That's our saying. We want wide margins because nobody wants a recount.
Tammy Brown, one more thing that an election official in Jefferson County mentioned, Wes Wagner, he said what keeps him up at night, what he's worried about is parking. Most voters at this point sort of have an inclination, he said, if they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, but they're not prepared to see some of those issues on the back of the ballot. And those folks that have come into our office, it's taking them 20 to 25 minutes to vote. If voters are taking that length of time at a polling location, parking outside could be a factor. Is that a concern for you?
It is. Parking in lines. We have, our ballot is 8.5 by 17 inches long front and back. And a lot of voters think they're walking in to vote for president, and they see the constitutional and statutory questions, and they see all of the judges for retention. And of course, Mid-Continent Library is on our ballot that's with a question, and Lee Summit is on the ballot with a question. So they walk in and say, oh, I didn't know all of this was on there.
Yeah.
So we tried to have some preventative measures this time. We actually went to our printer and had them print up sample ballots so our roving judges could be handing them out in line so people could be reading them.
Right. Well, that's
the voting booth.
That's Tammy Brown. She's one of the directors of the Jackson County Election Board, giving us some cautionary notes about what might be coming up when we go to vote 2 weeks from today. Tammy, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You are so welcome. Have a good day.
You too. Time for a break. When we come back, the mysterious case of Lloyd Gaines. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we discussed what draws some African Americans to the Republican Party. And author William Novak told us about coping with old age through jokes. Tomorrow, millions of children play recreational sports, and almost 3 million of them are treated in emergency rooms each year. We look at how those injuries can affect childhood development and how to prevent them. Well, it's been 80 years since the University of Missouri rejected Loy Gaines' application to attend law school based on the color of Gaines' skin. Gaines and the NAACP challenged the decision in a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The case drew national attention, and the NAACP wound up moving Gaines to Chicago after he received death threats. Gaines won the case. Then, in the strangest of all twists, he disappeared before he could attend school. The story is documented in a new book by two MU professors, the book Loy Gaines and the Fight to End Segregation. With us today from KBIA in Columbia is James Endersby. He's an associate professor in the political science department and one of the book's authors. And James, good morning. Nice to have you.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, many of us have long forgotten about Loyd Gaines, but you two in the book make the case that he's someone worth remembering. Why isn't he recalled more often?
Well, I think because the case ends with a mystery, there's not a clear resolution. It is, though, an important case, one of the first civil rights cases that went to the Supreme Court, and one that led to a series of Supreme Court cases up to Brown versus Board of Education. And everyone remembers Brown versus Board. They don't remember the case that started it all, I think.
Yeah, this court ruling came down shortly before Christmas of 1938. You two in the book called the decision startling. I'm wondering why, because it seems pretty obvious now what the court did, at least in retrospect.
It does now, but at the time, the Supreme Court was following the doctrine of separate but equal.
Plessy versus Ferguson.
Plessy versus Ferguson, that's exactly right.
Back from the 1800s, yeah.
1896, that's correct. And the notion that blacks and whites could be segregated in a variety of facilities, including education. And so the court had upheld that for such a long time. And it was a sudden and largely unexpected reversal that the Supreme Court made in the Gaines case.
And again, unexpected because...
This is the first time,
that
the Supreme Court applied the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause in cases like this.
Because until then, the thinking was that it was up to the states that they had the right to determine all things pertaining to race relations. And do I have that right?
Absolutely. The constitutional provisions up to that point applied to the federal government, but not to state governments. So state governments were free to enact whatever rules they thought was appropriate, including rules regarding segregation, racial segregation.
And just to be crystal here, this was the first time, you two write, in which the Supreme Court confronted racial segregation in education. This Missouri case, the first time. So this was a huge step forward.
This was a landmark case. That's right. There were a number of other cases about education that got to the Supreme Court, but they never ruled on the basic constitutional questions.
Who was Loyd Gaines?
Loyd Gaines was a young man from St. Louis, graduated from Vashon High School, went to Lincoln University, a very smart fellow, aspired to be a lawyer, and he was one of a very small number of people who would volunteer to actually apply to the University of Missouri and then seek support of legal counsel through the NAACP.
Because he knew he was going to be rejected.
Yes, they knew he was going to be rejected.
Why did he want to volunteer? Why did he want to be a guinea pig? Because, as you guys write, the pressure on these people, these guinea pigs, if you will, becomes enormous after a while.
The pressure was enormous. At the time, the state of Missouri had a program where, at least according to the law, they would provide tuition for black students to go to universities in adjacent states. So those few individuals who felt that they could continue for graduate and professional education fell under the confines of this law. And the Gaines case and the NAACP argued that this is a violation of separate but equal because white students could go to the University of Missouri and other state universities in the state, whereas black students were told to leave the state once they got to the graduate and professional level.
So in other words, the University of Missouri and the state of Missouri back in those days was saying, yes, you can go to graduate school, but you can't go to Missouri, but we'll pay you to go out of state.
That is correct. And some students did take up that offer. It was never a program that was fully funded, so they could never meet the demand of the students that were asking for this. But that's the basic logic, yes. If you want graduate professional education and you're a Black Missourian, you need to go out of state.
But yeah, that's just jaw-dropping, here you describe
yes.
it today. And again, you've done the research and you're used to this. I'm hearing it for the first time. That's just amazing to me.
Yeah, and for undergraduate students within the state of Missouri, the only state institution that Black Missourians could go to was Lincoln University in Jefferson City. There was no other state-run alternative. St. Louis did have its own local college that it ran, but there was no state-run university except for Lincoln University.
So Loy Gaines steps forward back in the 1930s. We're between the two world wars. I'm wondering to what extent, James, there was African-American unrest beginning to develop here, people saying this system is out of control, we've got to change it.
I think that's definitely the case. And you mentioned the world wars. That both has an effect before the Gaines case and after. The lead attorney for Lloyd Gaines, Charles Houston, was a middle-class lawyer in Washington. His father was also a lawyer. And so his experience in World War II helped for him to confront racial segregation in an area he thought was totally inappropriate. And he comes back to the United States with a desire he had never really had before to litigate cases on behalf of equal protection.
What was it about Lloyd Gaines, James, that made him so determined to take this case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court?
That's hard to say. Certainly, he was involved in the local chapter of the NAACP in St. Louis. As I say, he was a very bright fellow. There's no doubt that he had a good mind, perhaps not the strongest level of education, but he was very smart. He knew some of the local lawyers and was interested in a career in law. And the only alternatives to him, and I should also add that he comes from a relatively modest background, so he doesn't have the money to finance this kind of thing. But he does have that drive, which at least at the time, not that many people had that drive to stand up and be counted. And he was one of those who was willing to do that.
Tell us a little more about the personal sacrifice that he made to see this case through.
This is a young man in his early 20s who just wanted to go to law school. He agrees to contact lawyers through the NAACP, Sidney Redmond in St. Louis. Charles Houston is the national NAACP representative. And, of course, this case takes a very long time for litigation. This process actually starts in 1935. The case itself, it's at the Supreme Court level, isn't decided, as you noted, until just before Christmas in 1938. So we're talking about like a three-year period mm-hmm. where there was really nothing for him to do. He was a bright guy who wanted to further his education, but there was nothing for him to do. So he's stuck in this position of not really being able to advance his career. He is well known. He's very popular within St. Louis and Kansas City because people are aware through the efforts of the Black press and the NAACP to publicize the case. People are aware that he is willing to stand up, but at the same time, he can't really get a decent job. For time he spends pumping gas in St. Louis and things like that. Nothing that really fits his talents. And he's asked to wait, just to wait.
And again, he's well known because this was a really big deal, at least in terms of among Black people and the attention it was getting from the Black press.
That's absolutely right. There was coast-to-coast attention within the Black press to publicize this effort. The NAACP had several efforts that they were trying to pursue at this time. One, the director of the NAACP, Walter White, was pushing an anti-lynching legislation. But when Charles Houston came on, he was a really dynamic lawyer, the former dean of Howard University. He had gone to school at Harvard Law, was an editor of the Harvard Law Review long before our current president's tenure. He was a prestigious Black lawyer at the time. He really came up with a strategy: is we're going to make a difference, and we're going to hit the segregated states where they are the weakest. And one of the weakest points is these sort of laws like Missouri, where it's not a question of equal facilities between black and white. You could argue about were black schools and white schools at the primary and secondary level the same, but the argument that Houston tries to push is there are no opportunities for black Missourians within the state versus white students do. And so there's this really push to proceed on this level.
Is Lloyd Gaines receiving threats during these years as he's getting all this attention before the court finally rules?
Yes. There are some threats that are made through various sources on him. I don't know that he really felt concern about personal safety. It didn't seem to be a primary concern. It was more just there was nothing for him to do. For a little while, he went to graduate school in economics at the University of Michigan. The NAACP didn't know what to do with him. Right. They didn't want him to accept the tuition scholarships that the state provided. So it was more just keeping him busy. As we know, he's a well-known guy, but there's nothing really for him to do.
Did he keep a diary? Do we have a record of how he was feeling just emotionally about all this during those years?
There are some letters that he writes to his family, but he didn't have a diary, didn't really write very much down. He wrote a very short biography early on, like a 3-4-page biography of his life. And you get a sense he wants to make a difference, but at the same time, he really feels the pressure of all this public attention. He's a relatively shy guy who just wants to get an education.
If you're just joining us this morning, we're talking about the mysterious case of Lloyd Gaines. 80 years ago, the University of Missouri rejected his application to attend law school based on the color of his skin. The case wound up going to the U.S. Supreme Court, set a groundbreaking precedent that impacts people to this day. We're visiting with James Endersby, who is an associate professor in the political science department and co-author of a new book, Lloyd Gaines and the Fight to End Segregation. He and his co-author will be speaking about their book at 6:30 tomorrow evening at the Kansas City Public Library, the Central Branch, 14 West 10th Street. To RSVP or to get more information, go to kclibrary.org. How explicit was the MU Law School in explaining that its reason for rejecting Gaines was because he was black? Was that the stated reason, James?
Yes, absolutely. The law school and the Board of Curators and specifically denied Gaines's application for the reason that he was, in the terms of the time, that he was a colored student and he would not be admitted to the university reason for that reason specifically. The law school supported the Board of Curators all the way. The then dean of the MU Law School testifies in trial and supports this position 100%.
And the law school up to that point had never before admitted an African-American. Do I have that right?
That is correct, yes.
Yeah. This case lasted nearly 4 years, as you're pointing out here. And during those years, the NAACP learned some very valuable lessons. And I'm wondering, like what?
One is that you have to have someone who is devoted and will stick with a case through the very end.
Through thick and thin, yeah.
Through thick and thin. We talked a lot about how Lloyd Gaines really wanted to support this legal effort, but at the same time, he wanted a life, sort of. He wanted to something normal. And they learned that you really have to do that. Of course, they also learned, that, which they knew already, that the forces of segregation were intense. We haven't really got a chance to talk about it, but Lloyd Gaines won his decision before the Supreme Court, but that was not the end. The state of Missouri would not cooperate with that decision.
And so what happened then?
The state of Missouri, through the legislature, devised a separate black law school. They created it just within a matter of months, and sometimes the legislature and the bureaucracy move very quickly, and this was one of those cases. So the case is decided in December, and by September of that year, they have a black law school that's created through Lincoln University, and they establish it in St. Louis.
Despite the Supreme Court ruling?
Despite the Supreme Court ruling. Because now they say, well, we now have a separate and equal facility. The Supreme Court ruling says you have to provide something substantially equal for black and white students. And they say, well, now we've created this new law school, which is substantially equal.
A case in the border state of Missouri was particularly appealing to the NAACP. Why is that?
They didn't think that they could actually win in Mississippi or Alabama and it would be upheld. So they were looking for border states where they thought there was more of a chance that they could have the political support within the state from the black communities, as well as the likelihood of being able to achieve some level of success and take the case up to the Supreme Court. Remember, it's critical for them to have a federal case. They needed a national decision made by the U.S. Supreme Court. Winning in a state-by-state basis was only going to apply to that state. They did win a previous case in Maryland, and the state of Maryland dropped it before it could be appealed to a federal court. And so for a brief time, there was equality within the state of Maryland. They backtracked off on that later during the Gaines case, but they had to get a federal case.
So there's a lot of strategy here, a lot of coordination going on across the country by the NAACP to attack racial segregation, and this Lloyd Gaines case was all part of that strategy.
That's exactly right. And critical for the national effort was to have lawyers and newspaper publishers and leaders within the black community where the case could come from. So they were reaching out to communities such as the black community in St. Louis and in Kansas City to try to find someone who would serve as a good plaintiff for a case.
So he disappeared before he ever attended law school, and this is after the Supreme Court decision came down. What do we know about that? I mean, the insinuation here is he might have been murdered. Do we know? Or is it a mystery to this day?
It is a complete mystery. After the case
was decided... That's amazing. Mysteries don't last this long. This is a complete one.
They don't. The case was decided. He was in St. Louis. He visited Kansas City for a while, talked with a large group at the Centennial Church, got on a train to Chicago, was at Chicago for a couple of months looking for a job. And on one rainy night, he tells his housekeeper he's going out to buy some stamps, and he is never seen again.
Huh.
We have lots of clues, and we go over some of those things in the book. Of course, a lot of people immediately assume that he met with some harm, some physical harm.
Of course.
But there's no evidence of that. The FBI opened a bunch of old civil rights cases. There was never any evidence that anything happened to him because no one heard from him. He just disappeared. The position of the NAACP was always that he just got tired of the whole thing and walked away.
And vanished from society, in a sense.
And vanished from society,
he continued to live, but he just disappeared from society.
That's the view of the NAACP. That's correct.
What's your view?
That is probably, well, that's a really good question, Steve. I wish I had a good answer for you. the book that we promote, the view that we promote in the book, which seems the most likely case, is that he may have taken some money, a large amount of money from someone and left the country. There are reports that he went to Mexico City. There are at least some reliable sources, including a historian at Lincoln University, who support this view that that's what happened to him, is he just left the country. Given the fact that we don't know what happened to him, I think that's the most likely possibility. But we really do not know.
You wonder why he didn't come back and go to law school after he won the case.
Yes. Well, they were in the middle of a second case. The state of Missouri would not admit him to the University of Missouri. They said he had to go to this new law school in St. Louis, Lincoln Law. And both Gaines and his attorneys didn't want that to happen. So they were preparing a second case that they hoped to take to the Supreme Court, which could have been Brown versus Board of Education. That case that desegregated public schools, Brown versus Board of Education, was actually a series of two cases. We tend not to remember that much anymore, but there was the first case in 1954, which completely overruled segregation and eliminated separate but equal. But there was a second case that then applied the enforcement and allowed federal courts to enforce desegregation.
At all deliberate speed, right?
Exactly right. And that's what Charles Houston and Sidney Redmond were trying to pursue, is to get the Supreme Court to force them to admit white, to admit black students at the University of Missouri Law School.
You know, does Lloyd Gaines still have family around? I mean, do they have a sense of where he is? I mean, I suppose, is there some chance he could still be alive today? He'd be a very old man, but he could still be alive, right?
It's possible, but unlikely.
Unlikely, yeah.
He'd be 100 and something.
Okay, okay.
He doesn't have a social... He never got a Social Security card with the name Lloyd Gaines. There was a search in Social Security records for that, and... So we don't know what happened. Your question about family. Yes, he did have, he came from a large family. Some were in Detroit. Some lived in St. Louis. He's got extended relatives. The University of Missouri, much, much later, just a few years ago, gave him an honorary law degree. And I think it was his nephew, some member of his family, came back and accepted the honorary law degree on his behalf.
And the family never heard from him, obviously. They too?
The family never heard from him. It was not unlike Lloyd to disappear for long periods of time. He's a very, very solitary individual in many ways. So they didn't. They expect it. They never made a missing persons claim or anything like that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, why were you two so interested in looking back at this case? Just real quickly.
Yeah, Bill Horner and I, my colleague, both teach at Freshman American Government from time to time. The Gaines case is, of course, one of the cases we talk about in civil rights, and we talk about it to MU students, and there really has not been a lot written about the case. So we wanted to find out what was the real background of the case and try to provide the definitive story to the extent we could.
The new book, Lloyd Gaines and the Fight to End Segregation, you can see him tomorrow evening at 6:30, the Kansas City Public Library, the Central Branch, 14 West 10th Street. To RSVP, go to kclibrary.org. Interesting story. James, thanks so much for taking a minute. I sure appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
This week, State House Blend Missouri features the two men facing off in that state's Senate District 17, covering parts of North Kansas City, Gladstone, and Liberty.
Introduce yourself, please.
Well, I'm Jay Rainin Bechtold. I am running for State Senate 17.
Jay's running against the incumbent, Senator Ryan Silvey. We're talking with him later in this episode, but Jay's up first. A lot of folks come back from serving overseas, from a time in the military. They try to decide what they're going to do with their life next. You decided to run for State Senate. Why in the world would you want to do that?
I'm not happy with the way things have been going in Missouri. In my perspective, the attitude has been that we don't care about the little guy. We don't care about women and children. We don't care about people that are falling behind.
So I want to talk about some of those elements of your platform that you think would address that. Mm-hmm. Where I have found some of those elements listed is on a Facebook post that you had from back in March. First thing on your list was increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour. You know that that's been an issue that the General Assembly has considered over the last few years. Supporters have not been successful at getting the legislature to raise the minimum wage. How do you see that making a difference should you be elected?
$15 minimum wage is going to be an increase to the economy because you got to buy toilet paper. You got to buy diapers. You have to buy basic essentials. Someone who's making between $7 and $12 an hour are a little short on their expenses. You give them an extra $3 an hour, it's going to get spent, okay?
Also on that list was making unions stronger and standing up for workers' rights, you said. Is that an important part of your platform as well?
Yes, it is. There was the big vote earlier this year on right to work. I don't support right to work. Okay.
You don't?
No. It's I'm a strong supporter of workers' rights.
So I guess I have to ask you, one of the main things about this race is that mm-hmm. You received a very large portion of your campaign funding from David Humphreys, mm-hmm. Joplin businessman who has been giving money mostly to Republicans, to conservative Republicans, who are running against more moderate Republicans like Ryan Silvey, your opponent, who actually opposed right to work, who supported the governor's veto of right to work legislation. David Humphreys gave you a $25,000 donation, yet you, like Ryan Silvey, also oppose right to work.
Yeah, it was a surprising about that donation. Once I got the donation, there were a number of individuals, including members of unions, that advised me, you need to give that back. A Democrat cannot be accepting money from an individual like that. Had it relayed that, well, if I had union support, can I be assured equivalent amount of union support? But union support went to my opponent. So I'm looking at, it's a sad, unfortunate circumstance of our politics, and I hate every aspect of it, but you need some money to run.
Did you ever end up talking to David Humphreys?
I have never spoke to David Humphreys.
Does it?
Have never had a conversation with him.
That's fascinating to me.
I attempted to contact him, but I was unsuccessful.
He didn't return your calls?
He never returned my calls, no. But, I mean, knowing what he stands for, I think it's great that he supported and gave money to a candidate that is a pro-union candidate that wants to increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And if that's what he wants to give his money to, I say power to him.
Do you think he didn't even realize that you held those positions? Or do you think his anger at candidates like Ryan Silvey was just so great?
I won't speculate on his motivation.
But you're grateful for the money.
And I will use it to enact an agenda that will cause change in this state. And yes, it will be opposed. What I stand for is diametrically opposed to everything that David Humphreys stands for. Okay. Yes, I took his money and I'm going to use it in any way I can to go against the very principles that he is wrong on.
That's Jay Raynon Bechtold. He's a Democrat running for the state Senate. Thanks so much, Jay.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Coffee and donuts are still here, but now we have another guest. Introduce yourself, please.
Ryan Silvey, state senator for Clay County.
Excellent. Good to have you back on State House Blend.
Yeah, it's always good to be here.
I'm curious, as you have tried to articulate kind of your position, you have an opponent. What are you lifting up as the key elements of your platform this time around? What's your key issue?
As long as I've been in the legislature, balancing the budget and making sure that the state budget is sound is always a top priority for me. Currently, I sit as the vice chairman of Senate Appropriations. The chairman is now term limited. It would be my expectation to be elevated to chairman, and that's my hope. So being in charge of the state budget is an important priority.
You're a Republican running for that, sitting in that seat and running for re-election. You know, we spoke yesterday with Jay Raynon Bechtold, the Democratic opponent, who, as he talked about some of his campaign issues, I was struck by the fact that while he represents a fairly traditional Democratic platform in a lot of those respects, you have actually embraced a few of those positions, sometimes in contrast to your Republican colleagues. You have worked for and supported limits on campaign finance reform, contribution limits in Missouri. You've and of course, perhaps most notably, you opposed right to work.
Sure.
You stood with the governor's veto of that. Your campaign material calls you independent. That word is all over it. Do mm-hmm. you feel at odds with the Republican Party these days?
You know, at times, but I don't at all feel at odds with my district. You know, I think the district sends me down there to represent them. We have a party label essentially out of necessity, but I don't answer to a party. I don't answer to the leadership. I answer to the voters. And, you know, the right to work stand was not really a hard decision for me.
You talked about standing with the voters of your district. It's a middle class district. One of your opponents' prime positions is that he would support raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Would you support that?
Yeah, I think 15 is probably too high. I don't know that that will get you the economic benefit that that the supporters of that think that it will.
So would you support raising the minimum wage to some lower level?
You know, I actually like the way that we set up our minimum wage in Missouri several years ago, and that is that it has an automatic inflator in it. As cost of living goes up, I believe it's based on the consumer price index. As the consumer price index increases, minimum wage automatically increases with it. And we did it that way so that we wouldn't have this constant arbitrary number of, well, that's not high enough. Now we need to go to this number. Now we need to go to this number. We actually tried to tie it to tangible economics, and I think it works well.
As of October 1st, looking at the campaign finance filings, you've received this election cycle a total of $50,000 and change in contributions. You have more than $500,000 cash on hand.
Correct.
Your opponent has raised a total of about $26,000.
25 of which from a millionaire in Joplin.
Right, which we can talk about that. And he's down to about $1,000 in cash on hand as of October 1st. What do you make of that differential in your ability to spend on this campaign?
Well, I think it shows that his message isn't garnering a lot of support.
You think that all the people who are giving you money are connecting with your message?
I think in some sense, yeah. I think they're connecting with the message that I bring of building consensus. I mean, we don't agree on every issue, but there are issues that people can agree on and should move forward on. Regardless of fights in other areas, that's always been my message. So that's how I've been able to build a large coalition. That's how I've been able to build a war chest, as you've mentioned. Is, you know, people don't expect you to agree with them on everything, but the fights shouldn't keep you from moving forward on the things you do agree on.
In the earlier part of this episode, Jay Randenbechtold told us that that he has actually never spoken with David Humphreys. He was surprised to get that donation. That they've not had contact before or since, and that, in fact, he would agree with you. He opposes right to work as well. Does that surprise you?
You know, I say actions speak louder than words. When I talk to, the hardworking men and women of the 17th District, the fact that he accepted the money and the fact that he has no record prior to just joining this race makes people skeptical of whether he believes that or not. There were a lot of people that thought he should have rejected the money. If he truly didn't believe in that position. So I don't know what to think. I mean, if he had a record that we could look at, then you know, maybe we'd have some credibility. But, you know, taking $25,000 from the guy who's trying to bring right to work to the state of Missouri probably lowers your credibility when you say that, I don't really believe that.
That's Senator Ryan Silvey. He's a Republican from Kansas City, north of the river. And State House Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. Thanks, Ryan. Look for us at State House Blend Missouri online now. Thanks so much. See you next time.
To keep up with the latest political happenings in Jefferson City, search for State House Blend Missouri on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. The State House Blend Kansas podcast is there too. Be sure to subscribe to both. You can listen to previous programs and download our podcast. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up-to-Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's program, how to prevent sports injuries from affecting children's growth. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steichman. I'm Steve Kraske. And you are up to date.